Clacking together. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to go ahead and welcome you to Senate State Affairs Committee, calling it to order. Today is Tuesday, January 18th, 2022. So I'll move into the now and not 2021. Let the record reflect time is a little late at 3:37 p.m. We have present today Vice Chair Senator Reinbold, Senator Costello, Senator Holla, and myself, Chair Schauer. Senator Kawasaki has informed me, and I am going to do this based on the floor policy. Going in line with that, when you're talking, you can bring your mask down so we can hear you. Put it back up, please, in between. Senator Kawasaki will not be available. He has some personal stuff pop up, so he won't be with us today. I'd like to remind committee members and those in the audience to silence, turn off your cell phones, please. Staff assisting us, we have Naresh behind me as our committee aide for Senate State Affairs. We have Carrie with Senate Records, and we've got Jake behind us on the LAO with the new guy. There's one item on today's agenda. We're going to go over a lot of election questions based on where we sit moving forward with Mrs. Funamiai, from who is the director of the Division of Elections, going to be answering questions based on the election system and the process as we go into, really, quite frankly, a lot of this has to do with the new system with ranked choice voting coming, some of the questions we've had from the past as far as things that are still taking place, looking at election issues, and I'd like to make sure we can get the public on board so that they can see and hear, ask these questions, work our way through it. That's really what this is about today. So if we could go ahead with, before we go there, I want to get this out. We've got a couple folks that have testified before in Senate State Affairs. We have Christian Adams from the Heritage Foundation. We have Hans von Spakovsky. I always get it wrong. And we've got some other folks online as experts that can help as we go in addition to the director. So what we're going to do is we go through the questioning. Anybody that has a point they want to bring up that would be germane to the discussion, if they put their hand up or go ahead and ask, we'll go ahead and stop so that we can try to flesh out each of these to the end of what makes sense for questions and answer everybody's questions. So we're going to work it that way so we don't wait until the very end and try to circle back. One of my favorite sayings from the current White House. All right. With that being said, Director Funamiai, if you wouldn't mind coming to the table and put yourself on the record, you know the drill.
Good afternoon, Gail Funamiai from the Division of Elections, here to be responsive to your questions that you have for me today.
And I thank you for taking the time this time to come in person, because I know sometimes we've had to do it, you know, on the phone as the last couple of years have turned everything upside down. Okay, so for the ROE, like I said, the rules of engagement for today, I've illuminated what those will be. A little bit I want to talk about philosophically as we get into this for today. Since 2018, back to that. Thing. I have worked on multiple election bills, some of those for improvements to things like data security, voter registration, other things that we've looked at that have caused some questions about fairness, accuracy, etc. from the electorate. I've made it very clear here what I have seen since 2016. There's been people on the left side of the aisle, when you go back to the election of the previous president, they were very upset, didn't trust it. All the way up until the day of the election in November of 2020, there was articles that I put on the record in the committee about how it wasn't secure, it was dangerous, it was too easy to hack. And then after the current president was elected, it was the best election ever. And then I've seen the right side of the spectrum now upset and doesn't trust it in the fairness. So it's across the board, and everybody wants to make this a political thing that it's a left or it's right, and it's not. And we're not going to focus on that today either. And I'm not going to let people roll with the thing about fraud and the rest of it, because that's never how we started. There was never an intention to go down that path. So that's what we're looking at today. We have a system that we want to make sure includes all citizens. This is about voter access. This is about data security. This is about voter rolls. This is certain things that we're making sure that both the left and the right will be comfortable, that the election is secure and fair, and they trust the results. And I think really at the germane heart of it, that's what this is about, is trusting the results. It's not so much about who won. We've always been upset with the other side if our side didn't win. We're worried that the election results are fair and the citizens of Alaska trust it. Everybody deserves equal access to voting methods. There's some things here that we've brought out on the record. All these things are just reminders as we recage our brains. For example, Democrats tend to prefer mail-in voting on about an 8 to 10 basis. Republicans tend to prefer in-person voting about a 7 to 10 basis. So if we implement a system that's favoring one or the other, like Anchorage is trying to do with all mail-in voting, well, then you're basically disenfranchising entire sections of the electorate. I have had discussions with the press where they try to talk about my bill suppressing, for example. Well, you're trying to suppress the vote. Well, what about when the Anchorage Assembly tries to take this to a point where it's all mail-in voting that tends to disenfranchise conservative voters? Well, we didn't want to talk about that. So I think this is something that's a fair discussion that we have across the board. based on not disenfranchising any voters. The quality of our data is paramount. We've had data breaches and limited data cross-checking when we looked at this as we've investigated it. Create a system that's a little more compromised, is a little bit limited, and some inaccurate records. There's things we can do. This is not all, by the way, I want to be clear, on the division. A lot of this is statutory guidance, is policy changes as we go administration to administration. The question I have, Director, as we ask him today, are what are the things that we can do that would make the job easier for you? One, give you the resources you need to, and make sure that changes that would be made would go down the path that we're looking at, making it so that Alaska citizens are have more confidence in what the results are, regardless of the party. So I think we can strengthen our statutes so that they reduce that political influence. So we're going to go down some questions here for this. And at any time today, now as we get started, and I'm going to give you a chance here, Director, to have any opening statements. Just let me know when you want to stop and have the discussion, and we will drill down to the base of that. With that being said, Director, if you have an opening statement, you're welcome to take it this time, and then we'll just jump in and start talking about the where we are, the data, how it looks going in 2022. We can broach on a little bit of RCV if you would like to from ballot measure two. You're certainly welcome to, but we have invited you back to talk, you know, the broader picture like you're going to do for health state affairs, because I think that's important. The citizenry needs to be educated on what they're looking at because it is complicated. So with that being said, you have the floor if you have anything to open with.
Mr. Chairman, I do not have any opening remarks. I was told today's was going to be about what's happened since 2020, election security and ballot protocols, and then also just a briefing on ranked choice voting, also known as ballot measure number two.
Okay, thank you. That being said, does anybody on the committee have any opening comments or questions to start with? Okay. So the first thing I'll go just from a record perspective, Director, I don't know what your level of involvement it was in it. We have struggled in this committee as the legislative branch to try to get information from the administration, specifically the Lieutenant Governor's office working with them. Things, for example, the former Commissioner Shabaka's election report that she generated. We struggled for almost a year trying to get that report. I finally, about a month and a half ago, got the first chance to look at it. But when I pulled up the pictures of it, was to show it on my phone, I don't think, and I'm going to ask Steph, do we have the printout yet? Not yet? Okay, I will do that. Half of it was redacted. So a report that was generated for release to the public was presented to the chairman of the Senate State Affairs, and I can't read half the report. And by the way, all three pages of it that talk about what the recommendations were from that audit level report from the commissioner of the Department of Administration, all three pages were blacked out. Kind of hard to do my job. So one of my frustrations, Director, is not, and that's not you, that's the administration, but I'm going to ask some questions because you may have some information that would help us. And that is ultimately my goal. Is there guidance or things you have from that report and things that we can discuss that helped me do my job, that help us do our job? Because when I can't get information that was produced by the administration that is designed to be released to the public and the legislature so we could look at those things, it's really hard to do that when that information has been hidden from us to this point, and it still is. I was requested to sign a non-disclosure agreement so I could look at it. It's hard to do that and then talk about it when I'm signed a non-disclosure agreement. So there's some things here that make it a little fishy from our perspective as we work through it. So the first thing is, did you have any input or what's the right word here, guidance, feedback from that report that might be helpful to the committee from the report that was produced by Commissioner Shabaka?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have never seen a final copy of the report. The last I knew, that was still in draft format. So I have not seen a final copy. The division's involvement with that report was strictly to provide factual information to Mr. Leahy, who was the assigned investigator who put together that report. And the last copy I saw was a draft version, and I don't even remember the date of it.
Okay, thank you. That's good. I didn't know where your level of involvement might have been. Never asked. Since we have it here at the record, it just helps us clear it up. But since you said that, so that it's clear, in July of 2020, July 13th, I believe was the exact date, Commissioner Shabaka actually briefed the administration on the report, and I asked her before she left the administration. It was the final briefing of the report, and I know that's not your purview. However, I want to clear that up because this myth continues to propagate that this is a draft report and wasn't designed for release. It was, and that comes directly from the commissioner's mouth. She was asked to do this so it could be released for the public, and she has briefed the administration a year and a half ago. So I can't get the report fully, but I know it's out there and I know it's in final form. So not your problem, but something else to consider as we go through it. This is part of my frustration as a sitting senator trying to work on our election system. Can't get the data. Bit frustrating. So,
Mr. Chairman, you spoke to receiving a copy with multiple redactions. That obviously was not anything. The Division of Elections are not having to do with that. So we do have people from the Department of Law on the line if you have questions of them to ask them about that.
We actually do, but I'm going to look at whether we want to do that now or hold that till the end. And I'm going to look at staff that was looking because we were doing some coordinating. Do we want to hold that or try to go through that now? Because her point is valid. I just wanted to make sure we're clear. We knew where you sat in the process. If you had inputs, that's fine. Our struggle has been trying to get the information to do our job. Hold it for now. I think that makes the most sense. So, okay, so we'll jump into some other things. And guys, ladies, please stop me. At any point you want a question here, I'm going to go through a couple. We do have some folks online, but I am not sure how to know if they talk. So please, if you're muted online and you have something that you want to bring up, unmute yourself and just try to jump in, because otherwise I'm going to have a hard time hearing it. I may or may not see your hands go up based on the team's display. So there was a scorecard that was produced, and I'd like to go through some direct questions on this. And this will help, Director, just by having you with your experience in it, be able to tell us what we're actually doing there, pros and cons. And quite frankly, at the end of the day, I'm hoping that what you can do is provide clearance for us, or I should say clarification on a lot of the issues, especially with some of the things that we've talked about that have happened, like the data breach, the voter rolls, some of those things, to know as we're moving forward into the 2022 election with the redistricting, with the ranked choice voting, with all the changes, what points and things have been done already or things need to be done that haven't been done that are going to make sure that this election is secure, tight, fair, et cetera. So that's from that perspective, as we're answering questions, that will be very helpful. So on this scorecard, we're just going to rip through it so I can keep moving. Oh, sorry, Senator Costello.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Before we get into the scorecard, and I'm hoping that any time the state received a 0-0 on these items that we can get an explanation why we don't do these items. Could you tell us who provided the scorecard?
I can.
And then mention for the public the rank that the state of Alaska is after this scorecard was reviewed.
This came from the public, thank you, the Heritage Foundation. I get the, because we got two of them on the line with it. So they produced this as they've been looking at the state for a long time. And so what this has done is just give us kind of a springboard to be able to ask some questions and looking at the data that they have. And then having Director Funamia here gives us that direct link from the state so we can go, hey, what about this? What about that? Get the whys out and then see why we do or don't do things. And then that leads us into then what do we need to do with our job to make sure that these things are taken care of. That's how I want to approach it. So if I'm missing one, Senator Costello, let me know. We'll try to drill through it because I know your time is short as well. You have to leave a little early today. So if I miss one, just stop and go back over it. I've got some highlighted. I'm just going to go through those and let the others have questions if we see a score they want to get an answer. I'll start on the second one down. The state requires a photo ID or unique identifier such as driver's license, serial number, or last four digits of the Social Security number for absentee voting. The answer is yes, we do that. The question I have, Director, is this is a fairly significant one, is that data has been compromised multiple times, not all of it, but a lot of it. The Hess commissioner last year actually said that every Alaskan was potentially compromised in the data breach, and we know that we're having this. This is not directly anything at the Division of Elections. This is just a statewide problem. This is a worldwide problem. It's data breaches, and protecting our data is a difficult task. That's the world we live in. So, but my question for you is from the Division of Elections perspective from the state, knowing that we have an IT issue statewide and worldwide, nationwide, is what has been done since we know data has been compromised, as opposed to knowing that that data, those data identifiers are there, they're floating out in the dark web. What has been done by the state or what is the plan to make sure that that data cannot be used? Because we brought this up last year on the record as we talked about it. It is something that information could be used to get, for example, an absentee ballot could be requested, a mail-in ballot electronically could be requested. All the identifiers needed to send it in are available if somebody was to have that information. And how do we cross-check that? How do we stop it? What have we done? And do we have any new identifiers, or are we relying on the same identifiers moving into the 2022 election?
Mr. Chairman, so for when a person applies for an absentee ballot, they have to provide their name, their residence address, their permanent mailing address, their date of birth, and an identifier unique to them, such as social security number, last four social security number, voter number, Alaska driver's license number, provide a ballot mailing address, and also sign the application. And then that information is vetted and compared to what's in our voter registration system before any voter is sent a by mail ballot. And our staff actually pays very close attention to all these applications that come in and have actually caught some suspicious activity from people who have tried to submit ballots, applications on behalf of family members, say, and the division has alerted the Department of Law on these issues, and those are being looked into at this time.
Can you tell us how many those are? Just a rough number?
I don't remember off the top of my head. It was post-2020, and it had nothing to do with the data exposure whatsoever.
Okay. That'd be an interesting number just to know if possibly could get that back to us. With that same question, because you said they look at signatures as well, but we do not have a signature validation system in the state, correct?
That's correct.
So the question then might flow from that, what good is checking the signatures if we don't do a forensic check of them as part of the cross-check for the safety side? And I say safety in the sense of who they say they are is actually who they are.
Mr. Chairman, if there appears to be some kind of suspicious activity taking place, we do have access to every registered voter signature in our voter registration database, and those signatures have been looked at from time to time to determine if it really is the voter applying or if the signatures look too similar on multiple applications. We do look at signatures, but it's not required by state law. We look at it based on, intuition. And the staff at the absentee office has multiple years of experience in this. And I think there is a very public case about some of the information that they thought they deemed as suspicious back in 2015 or 16, I believe it was, and brought that to the attention of the Department of Law. And that has been looked into.
If you were to say there was a percentage of, intuition, because now we're relying on a human being that can be fallible as opposed to a system that would have a forensic check that we could rely on maybe a little bit more than just saying a person would do it. And that's not, understand these aren't spirits, Director. These are human problems that we're trying to contend with, and how do we make it better? Perhaps we should fund a forensic check system so it's there and we don't have to rely on people having intuition, right, for it. So how many as a percentage could you even take a guess that you look at, say there's 400,000 that come in for an election or whatever the number might be based on the current year, do you actually check?
Mr. Chairman, they're checked if I don't
I'm talking signatures specifically.
Like I don't have a percentage for you. Okay. It's based on if there deems to be a suspected issue with the application, then they're checked. But I don't have a number for you.
The reason, Director, I'm a little concerned about that is when I know we've had these data breaches, that's a lot of information. And if it's 113,000 and even 30,000 of those were used, that's a lot of intuition and a lot of checks. And so our concern is that you would have a case where it's not possible to check the amount of numbers we could have because we discussed this on the record last year. It's absolutely possible these identifiers could be used nefariously if a group wanted to do that. And the ability for us to cross-check that with the current system is basically relying on intuition and a human being to catch that. When you're talking hundreds of thousands of voters, that's a concern. And I don't know how we get around that right now. That doesn't sound to me like we have a way to really cross-check significantly the entire election process with that.
With signatures, Mr. Yes. Chairman, that is correct.
Okay, thank you. Long answer on that one. There's a lot of things here. I'll go right to the next one. State election officials run data comparisons between statewide voter registration list and state welfare and public assistance agencies to find information relevant to registration, such as address changes, deaths, citizenship status, or other factors affecting the eligibility. The answer is no. We don't do that, and we've talked a lot about voter rolls and the different methods available to us. I know there's cost involved with that, setting up systems, et cetera, but we did have that robust discussion last year about looking at other ways to have a more in-depth cross-check to clean the voter rolls as fast as we can because we know folks disappear. Look, we know that we don't even tell them. We don't educate citizens when you leave to go back to the division and say, hey, well, I'm gone. I got that I pointed out last year from the Maine. A state senator or a state house rep in Maine who used to be an Alaska resident left 5 or 6 years ago. He sent me pictures of the ballots him and his wife got. Even he said he tried to tell the state, I'm not there. He still gets it. So how do we cross-check those things better? It was a discussion. Can you tell why we don't, in this particular case, cross-check that list?
Mr. Chairman, we don't have statutory authority to do that at this point in time.
And there's a number of others we discussed last year as well that you don't have statutory authority to do as well, correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. We don't have statutory authority to utilize the United States Postal Service National Change of Address information. And the main premise behind list maintenance, Mr. Chairman, is that state and federal law, there's the National Voter Registration Act had a significant impact on how list maintenance was changed in the 90s. Prior to the National Voter Registration Act being passed, voters could be removed from rolls for simply not voting in two or more general elections, and the National Voter Registration Act prohibits that. And so you cannot remove people just because they don't vote. And we cannot remove people just because without the voter telling us, they giving us permission to remove them from the rolls. That is also part of the federal law.
Okay, and I understand there is a federal nexus here as well as this. So I think what this leads to is the question of is the why aren't we checking more? And then that falls on us back to getting information as a legislature. Go, you know what? We want to do better than that. We need to fund it. We need to give you the statutory guidance to do that. That's one of the things we're actually working on. So it highlights the direct answer of, hey, could we do better? I think the answer is yes, we could. But that's up to us to do that and give you that guidance. Anybody else right now? So far, no hands are up. And Naresh, just to make sure, I'm not missing anybody online, am I? Okay. If there's a point here, just stop me. I'll be on a roll. If the answer to the previous question is yes, which it is, the one that I just asked, or go through it, this is about election officials verifying residence address on all new voter registration forms by comparing it to county records, borough records, et cetera, city records, and we do that. And since we do election officials check to see how many individuals are registered at that address in order to find any anomalies, such as large number of individuals registered at a single-family home? And we've seen some instances that were reported to us about that. The answer is we don't do that. According to the scorecard, you can go back to like the Charlie Chan incident. Do you know why we don't do that? Is it just statutory guidance? Is it policy? What drives that?
Mr. Chairman, first, there is no statutory guidance in state law to require us to do that as part of what is required to register somebody to vote. And the all voter registration applications that we receive from voters obviously are taken. We all complete them just like a permanent fund dividend application and sign that the information we're presenting to you is true and correct under penalty of perjury. So the bottom line is basically, no, we do not have statutory authority to do that.
Sounds like something we need to work on too. I know we use IRIS, and as a cross-check of 31 states, brought that up before, but one of my concerns I have is that's 31 states, and that's great, but when I did the math on the states we don't check, it was about 135 million people. Kind of a big lack of things we're checking across the board. So I go back to when people tell me everything is great and fine, I go, no, we can do better. It's not that it's broken, and it's not that it's terrible. My point is that there are gaps that I think that we need to do better, which is why we're trying to point this out as we go. Election officials investigate the registration of individuals registered at the same address with only slight discrepancies to their names, and the answer is we don't do that. And this, okay, is there a reason for that? Is it? And again, if it's just statutory, it's fine. I just want to make sure we're checking these off so I know where we stand.
Correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. State election officials provide an annual report to their state legislatures on their voter registration maintenance procedures. The answer is no. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you.
That information, we do have available statistics if anybody ever wants them. We can.
Okay, we certainly have. got to highlight here, state election... was that Senator Costello? Did you have a question? Okay. State election officials in the U.S. Postal Service National Change of Address System to use the USPS's service to find voters who have moved from registered address? The answer is no.
Mr. Chairman, we have started implementing an internal we are sending notices to people who have change of addresses, whether they're in-state or out-of-state, and asking the in-state voters, we got this information from the USPS. Do you want to update your voter registration or do you want to cancel your voter registration? And the same thing to those voters who have moved out of state. Again, it is all voter initiated. So we're taking this as an additional step, not taking any action without the voter giving us the permission to do so, as an effort to try to, keep the voter rolls accurate.
Is that a policy decision that you drive, or is that statutorily driven?
That was a policy decision we collectively as a management team at the division decided to start doing, and I think we started it late last year.
Okay. That's one of the concerns I have, Director. I'm very frank about it up front, is I have some concerns that as a body, the body responsible for the statutes, the guidance we have provided at times has allowed a lot of flexibility in policy decisions by administrations and then directors of election with the lieutenant governor, et cetera. That makes me a bit nervous because politics sway with the wind. And if we have something where another administration can come in and replace you and say, we don't like that, we're going to do this without the oversight of the legislative body changing those laws, I think that's a real poor way. It's basically almost ruling by executive order. So it's one of the things we were looking at. We've had the discussion. You don't need to comment. I'm just putting it out there for the record again that I think we need to be as tight on statutory guidance to you as we can be so that we don't see a shifting of the political winds based on who's in charge. And by that, I don't mean the directors. I mean the people that are the politicians at the top that could come in and say, I don't like that. Do it this way without the oversight. That's a bit of a problem. If you have a comment, please do, but it bothers me.
I was just going to say, Mr. Chairman, that you know the Division of Elections employees are all nonpartisan and impartial. And we carry out the elections according to state law and state regulation. And, you know, like what I just mentioned was an internal policy, something that we decided was a way that we could help improve, hopefully, the accuracy of our voter rolls. Those kind of things I see as positive internal policy decisions.
Understood. And like I said, this is not again, a sphere at the Division of Elections. This is from, we are the body that makes the laws. And we have to have that oversight, I believe, to make sure that it is as tight as it needs to be. And my concern, once we discover that actually there can be a lot of variance in policy from administration to administration, is what pressure that puts on the directors of divisions to do things politically driven, as opposed to statutorily driven, where 60 people had a chance to vet those and make sure we like where this law is going, what they do, et cetera. So I think we're a little bit loose there, but that's just an opinion. I'll leave it as it is. Next question. And for Hans and Christian, like I said, I know you guys produced this, so if I'm skipping something here that's important or there's information that is not coming out correctly as I'm asking the question, please stop me. If the state uses electronic poll books and polling places, the registration list includes photographs of the registered voter, the answer is no. We use static printed ones. Can you say why that is?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
The reason for that?
Electronic poll books are not provided for in state law, and also it would be a substantial financial increase to the division's budget, first of all, to implement them. And also, they may not work statewide here because we know that, you know, over 130 of our precincts are in outlying rural areas that don't exactly have the greatest internet connectivity. And so it might, that's another reason.
Hopefully we can allay that with the broadband, but we'll see where that goes. I have a note here that says states don't need the authority to use NCOA. Is that true? From your perspective, what you know?
As part of the list maintenance process, I think it is true because that's one of the, I could get Tom Blinn from the Department of Law could comment on that, but that is one of the allowed mechanisms in which to conduct list maintenance according to the National Voter Registration Act, but it's not in our state list maintenance law. There is a fee involved with using that, and I know that our participation in ERIC, they do use, I believe they use that as part of their getting us the best last known address.
And thank you. You almost corrected me when I said Iris before it's Eric, so I just remembered I get that wrong. Apologies. So, yes, if the Department of Law wants to jump on with that, I've got a note here that states don't need that authority, as the director just illuminated. And the NBRA allows the NCO use. I hate to get too acronym happy here. I feel like back in the military. So if one of them wants to address that, that'd be great because it's just one more thing. You know, fees are fees, but, you know, there's a certain amount of money we need to pay to make sure our elections are as tight as we can get them. So I think that's something most people would agree with. But please, go ahead.
Mr. Schauer, Tom Flynn, the Department of Law. Yes, I think Director Finumi, I stated that correctly, that change of address is mentioned in the federal law, the NBRA, and not in the state law. But there are a few ways where that sort of information is coming to the Division of Elections. It's coming by way of ERIC. And it's coming, as the director explained, by way of these notices that the division is sending to voters who've moved. So it could be provided for more explicitly at state law, but that some of that information is already coming in.
Okay, thank you. I think that's an important part of looking at this, because one of our big questions from last year after a couple of years of investigation was we had a dozen ways of lists that we could possibly use. As the director pointed out and others, it costs money. And it can be complicated, computer program, et cetera, and that's all understood. However, you know, at what cost do you make sure your election is so tight that the citizenry trust it? And, you know, what cost is that worth? And obviously, when we're missing a lot of data and knowing that the public on all sides of the aisle is pretty shaken over the last 4 to 5 years of how the elections have gone, real or perceived is irrelevant because it may be perceived, but the public has to trust it. you know, what can we do to do that? And so I looked at the director and said, yeah, okay, we're not going to use 12 different lists. That would be a nightmare to do it. But maybe instead of one or two, we could use three or four. Maybe there are some other things available to us. So thank you for the answer. It's one of the things we're going to continue to investigate. What are options available to us? How much do they cost to implement? Do they make sense? And things that are available to us, I think we want to direct it, because as opposed to having to leave it to you to make a decision, that could be political. The legislature needs to direct what we want to happen with that and make sure we fund it. Senator Reinbold.
Thank you. So just a real quick point of clarification in regards to that, directed to both of you. Do you believe this needs to be put into state law? One, yes or no? Or do you have enough authority without that? And number two, just one of the databases, if you could just give the access fee.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, I think we'd have to look at that more. I don't know the cost for the USPS data at this point, and I think we'd have to have further discussions about the necessity of having that in state law, given that that information is coming in from the Division of Elections point of view.
Follow-up?
I have a follow-up, but can she answer as well?
Go ahead, sure.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold. Well, the division is doing that in an informal manner right now with the little yellow sticky that you get back on something. This voter has moved. Here's their new address, a forwarding address notification, and we are reaching out to those voters. The biggest part is if the voter doesn't respond, or the people who live at that address say, oh, they're not here anymore, and we aren't able to flag them as undeliverable, then they're never going to get targeted for our list maintenance process that's provided for in state law.
Okay, so, go ahead. Okay, so the gentleman on the was basically he didn't give an answer. He said he doesn't know the prices and he doesn't know if it needs to be in state law. So I'm just going to, one more time, do you believe that it needs to be in state law, that you need access? And two, do you know the cost of the database that you said you didn't have authority to access or whatever? Do you know the cost of one of the key databases?
But through the chair, Senator Reinbold, I do not know the cost of using the National Change of Address database. And the division, you know, I don't have a comment. I don't have an opinion on whether or not it should or shouldn't. It may be proving to be a useful tool. We have not been able to provide statistics yet to find out, just since we started implementing using the forwarding address notifications last year, how beneficial it is. But I mean, if we can get one person off the list that shouldn't be on there, then it's beneficial.
Okay. First of all, I'm going to start with a compliment. I really like the fact that I can go access for like $25 and get all the database, okay, from you guys. So it's cheap. It's easy. So you guys should know that fee. I mean, it just seems to me like you should know that information, especially if it's important, because I will tell you, people are really angry in the state right now. There is a lot of people that do not believe this election was fair. With his not being able, as a sitting senator, there's been on this issue, I don't know, 4 years or something like that. Anyway, to not be able to get data, that is reckless. It is irresponsible. This is not your fault. This is not directed at you, okay? But it's just not fair. I mean, and then what we need from you, and Gail, I do have a lot of respect for you. I have never had an issue with the Division of Elections, so I have an excellent relationship in my opinion, with you guys. I just have nothing but positive things to say from my personal experience with you. But I will tell you, if you could give us clearer direction, yes or no, we need it. You know, it's just helpful for us because we're really trying to bring experts to the table to try to get somewhere. And so definitive answers is really, really helpful.
So one of the things, Director, if you have an answer, please do. But if we could get some answers to that from Department of Law or the division, whatever would make sense, what we spend currently on, Eric, for example, I'd like to know what we spend, right? And the answer here was that, you know, we're already getting this data and using it, even if the state's not, you know, authorizing it in statute. But if we're doing it already, that kind of blows that out of the water. So I go back to, I feel like we have a lot of, oh, a little bit of this, a little of that, not quite tight. And I look at it and go, okay, that's not a good enough answer, folks. And again, like she said, I agree, this isn't directed at an individual director. This is at the system. If we're already using it, then perhaps we need to put it in statute and lock it down tight and go that we are going to use it and here's what it costs and we'll fund that and make sure you have the tools that you need available to you. What I don't want is an answer that is, well, yeah, it's not authorized, but we're doing it anyways. Or we made a policy decision, because I feel like that puts you in a unique place where you're having to answer questions like this, whereas opposed you go, you know what, I have a checklist. Here's what I'm authorized to do and this is what I'm going to do. There's no question. There's no politics. We don't have to call you to the hot seat and ask why you're doing it. And it alleviates that portion of it, because this is a concern I have with this. This is kind of conflicting guidance here. So I think we need to clean that up. And this is a part of that process.
Chair Schauer, if I may.
Go ahead. How
do you turn it? Chair Schauer, we'd be happy to follow up with the extent to which Eric already uses the NCOA information, the cost of getting the NCOA information on its own, and the extent to which the division's efforts to reach out to people who get those little yellow stickies doesn't already cover that information. We'd be happy to follow up with that.
I'd like that answer, please. And, Director, I know we know how much we pay on Eric, so somebody knows, and you may not know off the top of your head, but I'd like that answer, please, because this helps us make a decision on what can we afford. Again, I said we don't want 12 systems, but probably one or two isn't enough, clearly. Maybe we need to do better. So can you get that, please? Go ahead. No, it's fine.
Mr. Chairman, I can provide you that copy, a copy of the statistics that we have since the state started participating in Eric.
Okay, and that would include the cost that we're paying every year, correct?
That includes the membership fees and what it costs the state to print and mail all the notices to people,
okay,
and what our return rates are for the various different mailings that we do.
Because if we're paying for it, I'd like to know what those are. Senator Costello.
Thank you. So I just want to remind the public that this is a scorecard and we're ranked 25th. It seems like, you know, there's no mystery why we're 25th. And if we want to improve the integrity, it seems that we don't just cherry pick where we want to improve, but any place where we score low, we ask ourselves, do we need to change the statute and how do we improve our score? So this is not an arbitrary list. This is the methodical going through of how you improve the integrity of your elections. And I just want to make that, you know, known to the public who might be watching that any time that we score zero or low score, if you want to improve your integrity, you try to get that score up. And so I think, you know, it would be great if we had a column on the right. I mean, it seems like the comment that you're trying to make is that there's an arbitrary decision at the Division of Elections that, you know, we're going to choose to make this policy call, but we're not making this choice because we need state statute. If we have to go into our statutes and make them stronger to improve our score, I think we should do it in every area, you know, where we score low. Make the best effort we can to have the highest integrity that we can.
Senator Costello, I agree with you, which is why we're fighting this battle. It's just we find ourselves aligned against some pretty powerful forces blocking us in a lot of cases from interesting places at times. So I concur with all of that. We just picked some highlighted issues here that we thought were really important. We could certainly go through every one of these. Some are yes, some are okay, depending on the point of view. And I make it clear again, this is an outside agency that has just been looking at Alaska and other states for a long time, so it gives us something to go on with experts that have been doing election analysis and statistical data for a very, very long time. These are decades worth of experience we're discussing. So thank you for that. If there is one here, Senator Costello, you want to look at that I'm not asking, that's fine. We cherry pick because we don't have time with the director, unfortunately, to go through every one of these. Ones we thought were very germane to things we've already seen, already found, that we thought were really important to the efforts that we're looking at with the governor, with the other body, trying to have some election legislation that would help us move some things forward. So other follow-up comments there, Senator Costello? But thank you for that. That's a good point. I'll just keep going. The absentee ballot needs to be notarized or witnessed with the identifying information, such as name, address, telephone number, and signatures. We know that we do that. I have a note here that a two is not sufficient. There's just some things here. And Director, you don't have to comment unless you choose to, and you're always welcome to respond, or if you think a clarification, that's fine. I believe in the open debate to include sometimes a heated exchange. It doesn't bother me or offend me at all. We have to have that to get to the truth sometimes. We think there's some things we could do better. We certainly saw what happened with the witness signature on absentee ballots, where a judge decided they were just going to override election law, which to me is unconstitutional, because the one that writes the law, right of the Constitution, is this body. Not the judiciary, not the governor. We do that. And that was struck down in 2020 by one judge. So one judge writing election law is probably not the way our founders envisioned the state was supposed to run. So I'll leave that comment with where it is. But this is one of the things we're working on. It is a bottom line question for today. For one of the things I'd like to get from you and from other experts is, at the end of the day, what have we done with the data breach and that information? Have we changed the identifiers? Are we thinking about something that is different, another system, another way to identify, like a voter identification number, anything that would take the information that is floating in the dark web out of play? Have we done anything, or are we even considering doing anything? Perhaps the governor's bill I haven't had a chance to look at yet. Maybe they're looking at that. Is there anything from your perspective you've seen, or are we going to rely on the same identifiers moving forward, knowing that that data is floating around and could be used, as we've shown on the record? Is there any movement there?
Mr. Chairman, no. The division has not looked into any of the options that you just presented.
Okay. Thank you for the direct answer. That helps, because we believe we should have something there. There is a limit on the number of absentee ballots one individual can witness. No, we know that, and that's not really an answer. That's just there isn't an answer, or there isn't a limit on the. And correct me if I'm wrong. Is that is true?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. The state has a signature comparison requirement. The answer is no, but we've already addressed that, so we don't need to go there. The state requires a signed voter request for an absentee ballot. The answer is yes. It's electronic. It's one of the concerns we've had. Director, if you have a comment or opinion on this, it's welcome. I didn't even realize this early on until we started diving deeper that, you know, somebody can basically go online, have their identifying information. They can just request a ballot electronically. The form can be sent to them. They can print it out. They can send that thing in. So it seems like there is some – this is one of our concerns, that if there was going to be any type of malicious action with ballots, this would be the area it would happen electronically, because if somebody has the data – that's all they need to do this. And since we don't forensically check signatures or any other forensic background, how in the world do we stop somebody from using the data, because we are so weak as a state and really all entities, especially governments, in protecting data? It's just it's a hard problem. That's, you can't deny everybody's got to deal with that. So how in the world do we stop that from happening with this electronic type of ability to request a ballot? How do we do that? Do you have any thoughts?
Mr. Chairman, more a comment back on the 2020 election, how we saw no malicious activity whatsoever with any absentee voting, either by mail, in person, early, or online voting, or by fax. You know, and I think we provided information to you before about the number of voters who were involved in the data exposure, and we did a comparison as to how many people voted in person, how many people voted early, how many people voted by mail. And we were not able to find any incidences of fraud. But the online ballot system has been, you know, I think it's been on the books since the 90s, and it was fax voting back then, and then it moved on to getting ballots more in electronic version. If the committee would like, I would rather not take the time to get into great detail about that process, but I would definitely be able to provide you with a written explanation of the checks and balances we have in place for that type of system, if that is fine with you.
That's fine, Director, because, again, time's always our enemy here. But I am fascinated by the answer, not because I understand you believe what you're saying with this, but where I struggle with this answer is that when you say we did not find any fraud or malicious activity, I've never claimed from the beginning there was a lot of fraud. The press and others continue to use that, trying to hit me over the head with it, to say that that's what we're trying to do here, which it wasn't. I've never done that, and I could care less about the November 2020. It is what it is. It's gone. I'm not re-litigating that. I don't even want to go there. My question is, I go back to, which I asked you a few minutes ago, about the fact that with this data floating around and the ability to just simply request a ballot, and we have to rely on human intuition, and we don't do forensic audits, and we don't do forensic checks of things, take this in context, please, how can you sit there and say, we are absolutely confident there was no malicious activity whatsoever, even though 113,000 Alaskans had every piece of information they would need? Do you know how many of them voted? We've asked this before, so I'm kind of rehashing it. How many of them haven't voted in the last election, the last two elections, the last 8 years, 10 years, 12 years? Do we know? Because if I was somebody, I'm thinking on the red team, if I wanted to know and figure out how to throw an election where sometimes it's 1, 10, 12 people difference in an election that was important, I would find out who's voted in the last 4, 10, 12 years back. If they haven't and they were part of that data breach, I would take that data and I'd request that sucker. I'd turn it in. You can do a few dozen, a few hundred votes that way, and how in the world would you possibly catch it? Because you would have no way to do it. We've already admitted that on the record, because we're not forensically checking it. So when people tell me, oh, it was absolutely fine, I go, how do you say that? And I'm not, again, that's what I mean in context. I'm not accusing you. I'm saying, how can we possibly, as a state, so let's just take it broadly, all of us, we're government, how can we look at the people and say, absolutely, we're sure? We don't check anything to know that for sure. There's 113,000 people's data. Like I said, how many of them voted recently? What if they haven't? Did you go look at that data, the division, I mean, and check that? I don't think we did.
Mr. Chairman, I would have to go back and look to see how deep. I mean, I know we identify the number of people within the total number of names that were exposed to the data exposure and identified how they voted first at the polls, which you have to provide identification, voted absentee in person, which you have to provide identification, voted early, which you have to provide identification. That left us, it left a smaller total number of people who voted by mail, online or by fax. And I will have to go back and look at the stats, and I'd be more than happy to provide any information that we have available to the committee about how many voted this way and what their, you know, how many people had current or not current voter history, if we have that information readily available.
I would like to make it simple, Director. Yes, I would like all of that, because it's one of the things we continue to struggle with when I hear administration officials tell us there's nothing to see here and all is well, but yet every indicator we have by the data. And even if the number's smaller, say it was 70,000 instead of 113, 50,000. Well, how many of those? When our elections are one person, you know, to win or lose, or 12 people, as we've seen repeatedly, we have elections that are thrown here by a few dozen votes. Again, I would go back to look at Georgia, for example. You know, there's a move to change the election law so people can move in. There's a reason why, you know this, why you have a 30-day limit, so you don't flood a district and have people moving in there trying to throw an election. This is no different. If I was doing this electronically, we have opened ourselves up to something here that I think needs to be much, much tighter, because the answer at the end of the day is I don't think you can answer it. Not your fault. It's an unanswerable question because of how we don't do business. Well, have we authorized you in statute to do that? Don't think we have. Have we funded you the ability to do that? We haven't. So we need to. So I think we have – I would like to have a response here to that question, because this and the Heritage Foundation has looked at this, and I believe Hans – is online and had some further clarifying data. Hans, if you are there, regarding those numbers and what might happen.
Well,
could you put yourself on the record?
Can you see and hear me okay?
Loud and clear, and you know the drill. Could you put yourself on the record and with your name, sure, and who you are and who you represent, then please continue.
Sure. I'm Hans von Spakovsky. I'm a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. I'm also manager of the election law reform initiative. I appreciate the invitation from the committee to be here today. I do need to say that when analysts at Heritage testify in front of a committee, they're providing their own opinions, not necessarily that of Heritage. I just wanted to quickly explain that this election integrity scorecard, which we released in mid-December, as you know from looking at it, it's based on 12 broad criteria with 47 different standards within each. We came up with this consulting a lot of election officials and others to basically come up with what we thought were the best practices on all of these issues. It's clear that some of these items do need legislative authority, but I think there are a number of items on here that don't need legislative authority. They're something that election officials can do on their own. The key thing for people to remember is this is a very objective analysis. There's no politics in this. There's no partisanship in this. A lot of this will not only maintain the accuracy of your voter rolls, but will protect voters. And if I can give you one quick example of this, as you know, one of the items that you all discussed, which is in our list of best practices for voter registration lists, is to not only compare your list against DMV records, against state vital records, which Alaska does, but also to check it against state public assistance office records. The reason for that is that, look, there may be people who don't have a driver's license but are getting welfare assistance from the state. And getting that information when, for example, someone leaves the state, quits receiving assistance, or moves within the state to a new address, you may get that information from the public assistance office, and you're not going to get it from DMV because they don't have a driver's license. This protects voters as well as the accuracy of the list, because It's going to make it easier for the voter, if they've changed their address, in order to continue receiving public assistance, if that then is automatically used to update their address on the voter registration list, it's going to ensure that they don't go to the wrong precinct on election day. So I just want to make clear that many of these provisions, yeah, we talk about that they help ensure the integrity of the election process, but they also help protect voters just as that one does. The final thing I want to make a note of is this has been misinterpreted by some to think that it's an analysis of the 2020 election. It is not that. It is analysis of the laws and procedures of every single state as of December 2021, one month ago. And this will be continually updated. So if, for example, you in Alaska put in some of these best practices that you're not doing now, we will update the list, and that will help improve the state score. Any other questions about it, I'm happy to answer.
Thank you, Hans. Looking at the committee, anyone have a follow-up? Go ahead. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. This is absolutely very, very helpful. We deal with hundreds of issues, and anyway, this kind of precision and reporting really does help direct our attention and focus, so thank you.
Hans, I do have one quick follow-up. Thank you, and that is regarding the discussion we just had about the data hack, and it's a problem everybody has. It's not specific to our Division of Elections. It's just a problem. Knowing that those identifiers are there and we aren't currently working on a way forward that maybe we would change the identifier so we would take that out of play right now so that that wouldn't be floating around the dark web that could be used for malicious activity, et cetera, that conversation you were listening to it, do you have any thoughts on that as we went through that little debate there or that information and or any possible suggestions on how to perhaps get around this problem of that information out there?
Well, from the reports I've seen, I believe the data on 113,000 voters was basically downloaded and stolen by hackers. I'm assuming that the state knows which of those voters it is. What that would mean to me, I would think, is that a basic security step would be to basically put an asterisk next to the name of every single voter whose information was stolen, because obviously the electronic system that you all have for requesting an absentee ballot, the information was stolen that provides a hacker with all the information they need to request such a ballot. And even though the state does not do signature comparison on a regular basis, I would think you would want to mark those voters' names whose information was stolen so that a signature comparison is done on every single one of those when they request an absentee ballot, because you know that information is out there. I don't think it would be a good idea to just do it on a random basis. I think you would want to do that for every single voter whose information was stolen. I mean, that to me would seem like a basic step that you ought to take in that situation.
Food for thought. Thank you, Hans. Senator Bramble.
So I guess, thank you. That's really, really important because I know I serve a military base, and there's a lot of pretty high-profile military people, and they, several of them were telling me, even their kids like 18-year-olds and the people that rank pretty high, their information was stolen. And they're pretty angry. And I'm glad you brought this up because of the town hall. I'm glad he brought it up. So I think it's really, really important. I think that has to be in the law. That it needs to be identified. I think that is a great idea because that's one thing I had not heard about. And also, I would definitely like to know who, again, if we can find more information out of who did the hack, who has the data, what they have done to stop that in the future, because this is pretty dangerous.
Right. Well, the one thing I would say about this is, so far as I know, I haven't seen any reports from Alaska indicating who the hackers were that did this, although I kind of made an assumption, which may be faulty, that some Iranian hackers were indicted by the Southern District of New York not too long ago. I actually wrote an article about that. And I read through the criminal indictment that was, and they identified in that indictment that information on more than 100,000 voters was stolen by these Iranian hackers from an unidentified state. I may be mistaken in connecting those Iranian hackers with what happened in Alaska, but that's the only other official information I've seen on criminal actions against hackers actually successfully stealing this kind of information.
Thanks for that, Hans. Since Senator Ramble asked, Director, anything that you have available, we would appreciate that. I know that some of this was held, you know, more behind the criminal side of things, and I know the federal government was involved. I know more than I'm saying here because I'm not sure what my authority is to speak openly on it, but the state knows and the federal government knows, and the information's out there on who did this and what. Anything that you could provide to the committee would be appreciated. Within the scope and authority of what you are allowed to release. We have asked that, but that would have to fall back to some other caveats. But anything you could do for Senator Rambold and the committee would be appreciated. And then, okay, so you got some numbers and some things coming out there. We'll continue to move through the question list here as we had it. I do want to say for the record that it was, and Representative Christ Tompkins did say that I could say this and throw him under the bus, because the facts provision, which I caught so much grief from people on the left side of the political spectrum for trying to pull that out, he's the one that asked me to pull it out because it came from a Harvard report as best practices. So I have to laugh that I got grief from people on the left side of the spectrum when it was his request. So anyways, it's just one of those little side notes of this 3-year running battle on this. So we'll continue on here. Director, the state requires the receipt of all ballots by the close of polls on election day. We do not. Can you explain why we don't?
I'm sorry, which?
It's a question third from the bottom, second page, on page 2. It says the state requires the receipt of all ballots by close of polls on election date, and we don't do that. Just wonder if you could explain why we don't.
Mr. Chairman, you know. State law.
Okay.
State law allows for ballots to be received up to 10 days after the election for the primary, either United States postmark or international postmark, and 15 days for international in the general election.
Thank you. Just, this is for the record because we are just putting this out. We've discussed this on committee before. The state does not use unattended, unsecured drop boxes, and the answer is no. And can you just tell us what the drop box policy of the state is so people are aware of it?
There is no defined policy to use drop boxes. The decision to use drop boxes was made during 2020 due to the COVID pandemic, but there is no written policy on that.
So it's a policy decision, again, back to some of the things. Okay, perfect. Thank you. Next question. The state has procedures to investigate the validity of a registration when an absentee ballot is returned as undeliverable by the post office. The answer here I have is no. Could you just explain what that is or why? It's the next to last one there.
Well, there's no statutory provisions, but what the division does do is we look at the information the voter provided on their absentee by mail application to determine, one, did we make a mistake, a data entry error, and then we would resend the ballot, or is it a brand new address, and then we'll reach out and contact the voter and find out, you know, where do they want their ballot mailed to?
And I think you mentioned before you have made some changes on that recently. I've read something, somewhere in the exchange that there's something that you're doing maybe a little different with that, or maybe some additive things to update, and I may be stretching your memory here on this one.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
It's okay.
I draw the blank on that one.
Hitting you with a lot of questions here. Okay, has the state reviewed the recent Supreme Court rulings on the drop boxes and the potential for them being unconstitutional? Are you aware of that?
Mr. Chairman, I have not. I don't know if the folks from the Department of Law have done that or not.
Maybe if anybody in Department of Law wants to comment.
Chair Schauer, Tom Flynn again. Which question are you referring to?
Recent Supreme Court rulings on drop boxes and the potential for being unconstitutional. Have you guys just looked at it, or, you know, kind of war game?
Yeah, I'm aware of the recent Supreme Court case about it from Arizona and with ballot harvesting and other issues. Is that the one you're referring to?
Yeah. Yes.
Then yes, I'm aware of it.
Okay. Any thoughts from Department of Law on that, or anything that you're looking at that we might consider changing to prevent that issue for us? As far as without a policy, because it sounds like we don't have one, is there any thoughts from the Department of Law or the administration on how we might clean that up before it becomes an issue?
Chair Schauer, sorry, I don't have thoughts on that right now. If there is a proposal on how to do something with drop boxes, we could respond to that.
Okay. Sounds like it's something maybe we need to think about because of that before it becomes an issue. So that's why I'm asking. Thanks. Vote harvesting and trafficking restrictions. We have ballot harvesting here, so Director, just that's one of the things we know, and we're certainly working on a more elegant solution to it, and we proposed several, and we've had a lot of negotiations with other legislators, including the administration. So do you have any thoughts on the ballot harvesting as far as why we allow it, how it is right now, just policy versus statute? Same question. This is a generic question across the board, just a chance for you to illuminate for us the why of the things that we're talking about.
Mr. Chairman, I do not have any comment on that. I mean, whatever policy the legislature wants to enact related to that, the division will follow.
Has it been, let me ask a more direct question, has it been a problem? Have there been issues that you have had to overcome? So not opinion related, but just things that the division has had to deal with regarding ballot harvesting, people doing it perhaps when they shouldn't have, one person doing too many, as some of the court cases have flown through the U.S. right now that we're aware of, where, say, in a senior center, I think there's one in Texas where one person collected like 35 and did the voting for the people, and that person is going through the court system right now. So are there any issues that DOE has had to deal with regarding ballot harvesting that we might want to discuss?
Mr. Chairman, nothing comes to mind.
Okay, thank you. The state does not allow third-party, we'll just leave it. Well, because it has a zero from Senator Costello, the state does not allow third-party strangers other than immediate family or a caregiver to pick up and deliver voters' absentee ballots, and we just discussed that. The answer is the state basically lets people do it ad infinitum. That's even
Mr.
a word.
Mr. Chairman, if I may interject, the state does, there is a statute on the books to allow people with disabilities or illness who are unable to go to polls to get a ballot through a special needs process where they appoint someone to go pick up their ballot for them, bring it to their home. It's voted, and the personal representative serves as the witness for that as well.
Right, and I think we discussed that last year, and it wasn't overly concerning because you actually have a process there for that person. It's different than somebody going to the senior center saying, I'm here to help, and collecting a bunch of ballots, which we can do. We also know it was reported in 2020 that we had people that were being paid to come up to the state and harvest ballots in neighborhoods, and we had many people testify online about it, and that's a bit concerning because we have no control over that process and who does what and how they fill them out. And we had people testify to us, and I believe it was Huna. And he came on and said he had a person come up and open his briefcase, if I remember it correctly, with ballots in it and saying, hey, do you want a ballot? I'll help you fill it out. Probably not how we want the process to work. So there's certainly some things with ballot harvesting we probably need to tighten up, and we have proposed restrictions, including criminal penalties for people doing so. So we try to stop the practice. Senator Reinbold.
I would like her to comment in regards to this, because I have been involved in elections and campaigning a good part of my life. And this is the first time, in 2020, that election leading up to that, that I had seen people that were actually going out and collecting them in neighborhoods. And I mean, I ended up running into somebody that was doing it that I knew, and I was blown away. And yeah, they were paid, and they were brought up and paid to do this. And I was just totally, is that allowed, or is that what Crosby allowed, Judge Crosby? I need to know this, because this needs to be fixed, in my opinion.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, to the best of my knowledge, there is nothing in state statute that prohibits ballot harvesting. And I believe that, so there is not. I mean, and I don't know if Tom from Department of Law wants to speak any further on that or not, but.
Can I make a clarification? That's an important point. So thank you for actually answering and not being evasive. I really, really appreciate that very much. Wasn't there something in there that could not be done? And then what? Crosby overruled it.
Senator,
the signature
the chair, Senator Reinbold, the court system ruled that witness signatures were not needed for the 2020 general election. There are multiple election offense statutes on the book that deal with, hampering and just tampering with an election. I don't have them all memorized, but there are a bunch in Title 15, Chapter 56. That deal with election offenses, and the term ballot harvesting is not specifically mentioned in any of those. There might be something worded a little differently that might kind of mean the same thing. That would be something that we would have to, look into a little bit further. Department of Law might be able to comment on that as well.
One last question, and thank you, Gail. I really do appreciate you answering the question. So when Crosby overruled the witness, signature, did that make it easier for did I say that right, that she got away with what we put in the legislature when she overturned that? Crosby said he or she, Crosby, she, anyway, when she overruled that, did it make it easier for ballot harvesting is where I'm trying to get to.
After the chair said, I don't know about that. I don't know if it would make it easier or harder. I really don't.
Okay. Good. And if the Department of Law or the Hans, if you have any follow-ups to that, because ballot harvesting was an issue that popped up in the November 2020 election here in Alaska as an issue. It was reported on in the press. There was quite a bit of that going around, a lot of allegations. We had, as I said, we had many people testify to us in committee about what they had saw during that time. So it's something we've certainly investigated in our election, I guess for lack of a better term, reform bills. One of the things we're trying to do is to define how and when somebody can actually take someone else's ballot. Like, as the director pointed out, if you have somebody that's special needs, we don't want to restrict, you know, an elderly mother and father from their child coming to help them, you know, out in the bush to be able to get their ballots in. That makes sense. What we don't want is somebody paid from California or Texas or somewhere else coming up here and scooping up 500 ballots and turning them in and being paid for it. We're driving a different problem with there. So if there are any comments from you on those issues, that would be great if you have them.
Well, look, one of the
Chair Schauer, this is Tom Flynn of the Department of Law again. So ballot collection is not currently prohibited by state law, but taking a ballot and filling it out for someone else would absolutely be prohibited by state law, and that would be a crime. So actually filling out these ballots for someone else would certainly be a crime. And through the chair to Senator Reinbold, the witness signature case had nothing to do with ballot collection.
And how would you catch somebody from doing that? So they go in and take 20 ballots from a senior center just to help out, and how would you know that they were filling them out for somebody as opposed to doing it the right way and just taking a ballot and turning it in for somebody? What process do we have to catch that?
Chair Schauer, people would be able to tell if they were recorded as having voted an absentee ballot without actually doing that. You can track your absentee ballot to see if they've been provided and counted. And things like suspicious signatures, as Director Freeman and I has explained, based on their long experience, they can pick up on things like that.
That does drive this question, but we're relying on human intuition. So how do we as a state catch it if it was 50,000 people? We're not going to catch 50,000 people with a few election workers, you know, with their experience trying to look at all of those different things. I'm looking at the process, Tom. That's why I'm looking at the process of it as opposed to relying on human beings. That's my point. Where are we weak and where can we do it better? So that's what I'm asking, because I see a hole here and going, there's no possible way you're going to catch all of those and do that. So, I mean, I'm not asking you to answer the question. I'm just saying, hey, this is an area that we probably need to do something better. And then I'll have
understood, Chair Schauer. And if you're proposing, you know, new direction from the legislature, that's obviously your prerogative. At the scale that you're talking about, 50,000 voters, things like that, we would have seen things like a massive increase in duplicate votes if people were filling out absentee ballots on behalf of other people, if people were realizing they were recorded as having voted without having voted, and there just wasn't evidence of that in the last election.
And I'll go one last thing here, and I'll let Senator Reinbold, and we'll get to you, Christian. I see you popped up with your hand. Thanks for that. I think I probably want to reiterate my question to you. It was not that we wouldn't catch people that were looking to see if they voted and didn't, and they check the system and go, hey, I voted even though I didn't, or vice versa, which we had people testify last year that happened to them. My question was, they go to a senior center and they say, hey, let me take your ballot, because we've seen this across the lower 48. We've investigated. There are court cases running through the system right now. They said, let me help you out, and I'll take those. One of them was 35 ballots. Filled them out for the people, and they go, oh, well, I voted because they helped me and they turned it in, but who knows how they voted for that person, right? That's my question. To be more specific, was how would we catch that? There is no process to catch. I don't know that you even could. Because once somebody's given the ballot and assumes they voted, they don't care. It's gone off. But somebody could maliciously do that, right? I mean, that's a problem with harvesting. How do you know, as the state, how can you validate that somebody that harvests those ballots doesn't do something malicious with them? Can you?
So, Chair Schauer, I think the fair answer is that there's always some amount of fraud that is going to be impossible to detect. And that's why when you review elections in hindsight, the question is whether or not there was enough to change the outcome. And there are no perfect elections. So the best that the division and the rest of us can do is to run the best election you can and to, by making things criminal, deter people from doing these activities.
You took the bait, and thank you for that. I will appreciate it. The answer is you get rid of ballot harvesting and you make sure people can't do that. That's the answer. You don't sit there and rely on something when there's no way to catch it. You make the system better. But you helped me with the answer, so thank you for that one. And we're going to go to Christian is up for a moment. I know you popped up with your hand, so please, if you have a comment clarifying, put yourself on the record. You know the rig here, please, and go ahead.
Thank you, Senator. My name's Christian Adams. I'm the president of the Public Interest Legal Foundation, a nonprofit law firm dedicated to election integrity. I would draw the legislature's attention to a case that I will disclose I worked on while an attorney at the United States Department of Justice. And it relates directly to your question, and it gives the legislature all the reason it needs to ban ballot harvesting in Alaska. And I'm going to give you the citation for the record so someone can go back and pull the case and read the many pages that will disclose to folks how ballot harvesting really works from the inside and why Alaska should ban it outright. The case is called United States versus Brown, and the citation is 494 F sup second 440. It was decided by the Southern District of Mississippi United States District Court, that's a federal court. The United States obtained a judgment against individuals who were involved in ballot harvesting. And if you read it, it is both tragic and alarming because the victims describe a process where the ballot harvesters use social relationships to vote their ballots. And it is not easy to detect. It is not easy to detect when bad things happen. It took a lot of work. You can read about it in the opinion. But it is a clear example why the legislature of Alaska should ban ballot harvesting.
Question.
Yeah, and if I can just add something very quickly, Hans von Spakovsky again.
Go ahead.
Look, no one is talking about limiting the ability of voters to return their absentee ballots. If you look at our standard, we make it very clear that voters ought to be able to mail the ballot back, deliver it themselves, members of their family should be able to deliver it, and designated caregivers also for those who are sick or disabled. But it is just unwise policy to give third-party strangers who have a stake in the outcome of the election. Because what you're doing if you allow vote harvesting is you're allowing candidates, campaign staffers, paid political operatives to go to people's homes to pick up their ballot, which puts them into a position to alter and change those ballots. That can easily be done with election officials having no idea that it's happened. It's also very easy for those individuals to, for example, not deliver ballots if they are in a neighborhood and they know the voter histories there, that those individuals are not going to be voting for the candidates they are representing. And you know, how many voters are actually going to call and check to make sure their ballot was delivered? A very tiny percentage. So again, you know, the possibility of detecting this is very slim. Plus, the final reason you should not allow this is that, look, you've got laws like every other state to prohibit campaigning and electioneering in polling places so that voters are not bothered and unduly influenced when they're waiting in line to vote. If you're allowing these same campaigns to go to people's homes, you have no one there, no election officials, no observers that can prevent that from happening and prevent those individuals from pressuring and attempting to coerce voters to vote a particular way. And all of that is reasons why you should not allow third-party strangers to pick up and deliver absentee ballots.
That is an excellent point that I hadn't even considered. I don't even know if we discussed that yet, that we're basically violating the law by allowing ballot harvesters because they can't do it inside of a polling place, but we're letting them go to people's homes and do essentially the same thing. That is a very good point that we're going to have to consider. Thank you. Go ahead, Senator Rambo.
Okay, so back to Mr. Flynn, I have two questions. I understand, you know, that Danny Crosby, Judge Crosby, threw out the witness signature, COVID, whatever it was related to. But I want to find out from you if you think that allowed any more freedom in collection or harvesting or not, because to me it seems like it would have reduced it, and you know, this ability to go collect and it would be a lot quicker. So anyway, do you think it would help increase election integrity, yes or no? And then I have another yes or no question. Having that witness signature, just a yes or no.
through the chair, Senator Radbolt, the witness signature as it relates to ballot harvesting, that's your yes or no question?
What I'm saying is, would it improve election integrity with the signature, witness signature? Yes or no?
Yes, and if I may expand on that through the chair. So when the state defended the witness requirement in the Alaska Supreme Court, we argued that it was a deterrent to fraud. And when they ruled on it, they didn't buy that argument, but the state appealed that and defended that position. And it's worth noting that the witness requirement is back in place for future elections.
Your second question?
Go ahead.
Yeah, and I just want to prevent it so it doesn't happen because if there's another COVID, which there may be, you know, I don't want this to happen again. So the second question I have for you is, would you, yes or no, support a forensic audit? Because we're representative republic, and the people are upset. There's a lot of people that don't believe this was a fair and effective across the nation. There's a lot of people. So would you support a forensic audit if you, if money wasn't the issue? Would you think that that would be a good thing just to make sure we have the public trust, because there's a lot of shaken trust out there in the state of Alaska right now. Would you support it if money wasn't the issue?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, you know, I'm here to help the Division of Elections and talk about the law. For the positions on a forensic audit, you'll have to go to the administration or others for that. But the question will be, what's the direction for that? What's the funding for it? And what's the purpose?
I will answer that for you, Senator Reinbold. The answer from the administration, Lieutenant Governor's office, was no. They do not support a forensic audit. I don't know why, with the issues we have. And I go back to the not the to point at Division of Elections, because they can't control that, was the data breach. Why in the world we did not go back and use the forensic data to look at this was, I do not agree with that decision, but it's not my decision to make. I can't force it. So there's your answer. If you have a follow-up, go ahead.
And then I'll ask Gail as well, because Representative Republic is a foundation. You know, they send us here and we're their voice, and they want to make sure their vote counted. And there's been a lot of red flags. I think this is the third year we've been dealing with this issue. Just to make sure that the public trusts the integrity of the elections, would you support a forensic audit of the 2020 elections?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, again, the division will implement whatever policy that the legislature passes, and we will do our best to ensure that we uphold the law like we always do to the fullest extent. I do want to say, while it wasn't a forensic audit, we did do an unprecedented hand recount of a statewide ballot measure, and that did not show that there was anything nefarious going on with the ballot tabulation equipment. Those results are available on our website. Over 300,000 ballots were sorted by hand by a multitude of bipartisan election workers counting yes and no. So that was the first time ever for doing a hand count for a statewide ballot measure. And while it didn't come out perfect, but it wasn't enough to say, oh my gosh, you know, there's something funny going on here, it did not overturn the results as certified by the state review board.
Okay, so just as a follow-up to that, I have heard that. That's the same answer I got from the Lieutenant Governor. I think I've sent a dozen messages on that. There's trust issues in the state, whether it's your hand or an audit. I mean, if there wasn't an audit, I think it's a couple million dollars anyway. They asked me to try to do it through ledge budget and audit. You know, and I was like, wait, the Lieutenant Governor doesn't have a tremendous amount of responsibilities, and this is something that is so doggone important to the trust and the people of the state. So, I think we really need some better than just a little hand count. But I think the other element was the hand signatures, the ballot harvesting, you know, all that kind of stuff. But there's something, I've never felt, the Dominion machines, we could get all into the Dominion machines and things like that. But I do think, just because I've never heard so much concern before, we have to go and answer to these people. And that's why it's important for us to be able to know that where does the buck stop? Does it stop that we needed a law? Is this the Lieutenant Governor? You know, where does it stop? And if it's just a money thing, why not do a forensic audit, since there's so much disarray out there right now? And people don't want it to happen again. They don't. And that's what our fear is. We want them to trust the election integrity.
I think Senator Reinbold, and I'll go to the director here, administration can always pipe up. My concern moving forward is that, you know, that election happened. The, you know, ballots thrown away, envelopes, data, you know, it's a hard thing to go back. I get that now based on how we did. The potential moving forward, making sure that the information is available to us at all times to be able to do the forensic audit, I think is important, because I don't know that I want to go backwards in that. I want to make one correction, and this is how it is framed and spoken about. The Lieutenant Governor has said at times, well, we did an audit. We didn't really do an audit because the audit we're discussing goes much deeper than that for data, who voted when, et cetera, the things we've discussed. When we do a hand count, that's the appropriate way to say it, Director, like you just did. We just did a hand count. That didn't really tell us much except that the number of ballots that went into and out of the machines was the same. We never tracked. Is that a breach? Was it used? Did anybody maliciously, the state actor that took this information, did they do anything with it? That's the kind of audit trail we're looking at because it doesn't tell me too much that the ballots were the same going in and out. What tells me, were any of those ballots inaccurate? Were any of those ballots malicious? Were any of those ballots voted on by somebody that didn't actually vote on it? That's the issue at hand. So we have, I go back to, we don't know. And I don't want to, I go back to this. I'm getting tired of being told I'm trying to relitigate the 2020 election. I could care less. I don't care. I'm moving to the next one. What happens? How do we make sure the next time around we don't have ballot harvesting, we don't have data used inappropriately, we don't have people getting online ballots with the information that's floating around the internet? That's what I'm concerned with moving forward. It's almost like I don't care that we do, or I care that we do the right thing regardless of who wins. Because I've had some people hit me, go, well, it's like, you know, all your people win the election cycle, you know, all the red side. Great. That kind of makes my point. I don't care who won. I care about it being fair, appropriate, good voter access to everything, and that the people trust the election cycle. So I just want to make that caveat because I've heard this narrative pushed by a lot of folks, including the press, that continue to say, well, we did a check of all the ballot measures too. No, we didn't. All we did was check that the numbers count. That's one little piece of looking whether or not there was an actual issue. So that's just my opinion for what it's worth. I'll go to the next question, but I do have one, Director, if you could, just a piece of information. I know you're writing it down. Could you tell us the number, or when you get it, because I know you don't have it on top of your head, the percentage of absentee ballots that arrived at DOE via the Postal Service versus ballots that were brought in by another voter, if we could get that information? And I'm sure you probably don't have that on hand.
Mr. Chairman, we would not have that information at all.
Could you
a ballot comes back, why? It comes back.
Could you explain why? Because I think that's important for people.
We don't code them when they come back to the office, how they're received, if they're returned. If it's an absentee by mail ballot, and it comes back to our office either by the post office or they drop it off at a polling place or they drop it off in person, it's still logged and received as an absentee by mail ballot.
What happens to the envelopes, the information, once they come back and those things are turned in?
They're kept for 4 years.
For 4 years, right? Without that. Okay. There's some interesting things we'll talk about there on that one. Let's finish up because I know we're almost done, Director. You've really been patient with us, and I appreciate your time. We're almost done. A few more quick ones. The state uses the Systematic Alien Verification for Entitlement Save program. It was discussed before. To help identify non-citizens who register to vote? The answer is no. I'm guessing because there's no statutory guidance? Or is that wrong?
Mr. Chairman, that's my assumption, yes.
So is that a policy thing that you could just do it?
I'm not sure what the requirements are, Mr. Chairman, of being able to use the SAFE program.
Could you get an answer for us? Because I'd like to know if that's something that we can do policy regulation-wise as opposed to having passing legislation. Sounds like we've got a lot of room to wiggle with policy versus legislation, one of the issues we're having here. And if we can, I'm going to ask that we do.
I will check into that.
Thank you. The next one, the state does not connect the voting and tabulating machines to the internet. I don't want to spend too much time because we could really chase the rabbit hole here. But the answer to that is yes. But we have had some issues, Director, where we have discussed, for example, my wife, who works at one of the polling places up in the Massey Valley, watched the gentleman take the modem out, go outside, and try to connect it to a cell tower to pass information down. So just at the 30,000 foot view, again, because I do not want to, at 5 o'clock, I don't want to chase the rabbit hole in this one too far. The state does not connect those. However, there is the ability for the machines to connect if they are set up to do that. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, there is an ability for the machine that has an internal modem to transmit results if they can get modem connectivity.
Okay. One of the concerns we had about hacking other stuff, again, not going to go down that rabbit hole today. I do suggest for the folks that are watching the public, if they see this, if you have not watched the public documentary, the HBO special Kill Chain, you need to, because it describes how the machines are hackable, and they try to tell us they're not, and it's great, and I'm not saying the Division of Elections, we're talking about the manufacturers, and in fact, that's been disproven many times. So it is very important to understand that we are vulnerable, because anything electronic, anybody that tries to tell us is not hackable, you're wrong, and you clearly don't understand the electronic world we live in today. Look at what we're facing. That is a big problem for all of us. I believe that you would also be surprised to see that Alaska got a nice footnote in that film, because we talked about the hacker in 2016 that had a backdoor access to all of our systems. And so these things have been validated throughout. So it's an interesting documentary that just kind of talks about these things. It would be worth your time if you haven't seen it. Last couple questions, Director. The state legislature has standing to sue with compliance and election laws as passed by the legislature? The answer is no. Do you know if that's just because it hasn't been passed and law and given us the statutory guidance? Is anything else to add to that?
Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding.
Thank you. Any chance changes to the state election laws via court settlement require the approval of the state legislature? The answer is no. Again, you don't have to comment on these. It's fine. I'm just making the points here of things that make it hard for us to do our job, depending on what we see. The state does not automatically register voters. The answer is no. Opt-in, one of the things we're discussing, especially with the PFD, because as we have discussed before, that has made it hard for us. I'm not saying us, the state. With that, what we found with the transfer of data from the PFD division to the Division of Elections, that there was no real cross-check on the background information. It was just accepted. So that's one of the things we would like to make tighter in the system, because obviously if you're accepting the data and it has not been validated by the PFD division, then that could set up some problems, which that, by the way, came from the Lieutenant Governor's office as one of the things they wanted us to look at, and we took that on. So I think that's an important one there. And that's going to be the end of the question sheet for now, because we've run out of time on that, and we're a little after 5. So, Senator Reinbold, do you have something
to say? Very, very quickly, because of the permanent fund dividend and everybody reapplying for it every year, it seems like, you know, you've got the DMV records, the public assistance data, the permanent fund dividend. It seems like Alaska should have the cleanest voter records around. Does that database, do you have access to it, and is it helpful? Yes or no?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, we do not have immediate access. We do not use DMV for voter registration purposes, so people can register to vote online as long as they have a driver's license. DMV records are used as part of ERIC, the multi-state cross-state that we do with other states. We do not have access to the public assistance database, and as you mentioned, we do have access to the permanent fund dividend through the automatic permanent fund permanent fund dividend automatic voter registration program, which was enacted as a result of a voter initiative in 2015.
Thank you.
Okay, and what we have here is I've got a couple key questions here that I've got to my staff, and Director, if you'd stay, because you may have a role in answering this, or the folks online. I've got the answers here. I'm going to go through, or the questions. I wish I had the answers. I have the questions here. I'm going to roll through them real quick, and almost said Senator. Scott will jump on and put yourself on the record if I am missing something. A couple of key questions, Director, and the two I have remaining, just a few more minutes and we'll be done. And I did give you guys advance warning we might go to 5:30. We're not going to go that far. But I just, while we have everybody here, I'd like to discuss these. So, Scott, I'm going to go through what I have at the moment. And if I miss a couple key ones, as we discussed previously, because we've been going for a while, please, then I'm going to have you jump in and just remind us so that we can have the experts answer. Okay?
Thank you.
All right. So, let me get over
for the record. My name is Scott Ogan. I'm Senior Policy Advisor to Senator Mike Scott.
Get to page 5. Thank you. So I'm trying to keep up with a lot of paperwork here, a lot of notes. On page 5. So voter identifiers are compromised by the data breach. Director, we kind of alluded to this before, but just finishing the discussion. Will a new voter ID system be in place for the next election? Anything that's going to go through that as we discussed before, and I think your answer was no, but I want to make sure we've asked the appropriate questions, that nothing so far has been proposed to change the identifiers moving into this November's election.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct at this point in time.
Mr. Ogan, was there other germane parts to that question that I am forgetting at this point?
No, sir, but her concern is that...
Just have on record,
for the record, Scott Ogan. The concern is... I think it still hasn't been addressed that it's plausible that under our statutes, the person applying for an absentee ballot online could potentially, if they were armed with the data that was stolen, for example, that they could nefariously vote for a person, and if they were selective about who they were voting for, if they pick people that say are registered to vote and haven't voted in 4 or 5 years, and only voted for those people, and let's say there was a particular issue that they knew was going to be very close in the election, they just needed to push it over a few extra votes. I'd like to know if the director thinks it's plausible that it could have been done on a more organized basis, and they apply for those ballots online, they get the ballots, if they're very sophisticated, possibly fill out and vote for those people in place of those people with their security identifiers. Would the division have any idea if they could pick up on that was possibly done? Is it plausible, A, and B, would they even know that they did it?
I know the director, you've answered that partially before, maybe even completely, that you don't believe it happened. But to Scott's question, plausible, possible, I guess maybe is a better way of saying it, that some of those could have been used by somebody and very hard for us to catch them based on the things we pointed out previously.
Mr. Chairman, that's speculative.
Sure.
Understood. I have not personally seen it happen, but that doesn't mean that people do commit fraud.
Understood. And I understand I'm asking you, this is the speculation moving forward, and nobody knows what the stock market is going to do for the next 30 years. Understood. Did you get the second part of that, Scott? I think you got your answers there.
I think I got the answer.
Okay, so going to the next one here about the Dominion machines. We had some kind of conflicting data from the Lieutenant Governor's office. Are the Dominion machines equipped with modems capable of transmitting or receiving data via cell towers? The answer is yes, but we had been told before that they were not connected to the Internet. Have the Dominion machines been forensically examined by anyone? If so, by whom? And is the information available? The answer was no. And I will tell you, Director, that that was part of the information I was told exists in the report that I can't seem to get my hands on without signing away my life's savings. So if you have any comments there, that would be fantastic on this particular one. But that's kind of where we sit right now with not understanding, is there something we need to do about those machines? Or do we need new ones or different ones? And I can't get the data to make a decision about what the legislature might want to do.
Mr. Chairman, there is no, in the time I have been back as director since 2019, there has been no forensic audit of the Dominion voting equipment. The 2020 elections were the first time these new tabulators were used. Prior to that, the division had been using Dominion equipment back to 1998.
Right, so we've had
there is significant functionality testing that is done of the units. There is significant logic and accuracy testing that is done of the units prior to each election that is done by two different bipartisan boards.
Are those independent companies, or you said boards?
No, they're boards. They're voters of Alaska, bipartisan, made up of all different party affiliations. Some of that testing is done here in Juneau, and then the regional offices do the testing of all the equipment that they deploy out to the precincts.
Do we have a third-party vendor that's an expert in IT and security that does that? It sounds like no.
Nope. Okay. No, sir.
Interesting, because I would think that's something we would want to do with people that do that for a living, because there certainly are some out there. But one before you go there. And I understand in the report, as it's been alluded to me, that there are some answers about these questions we have here with these machines, about how they were purchased, whether those things did happen or not. And once again, I just go back to, I don't know, because I can't see it. It's blacked out. I'll leave that for the record. Senator Reinbold?
Thank you. And no forensic audit. That is good. I like the clear answers. Do you have any idea how much it would cost and how many machines would need to be for forensic audit? Let's just say one of them, or even, I don't know how many we have, but how many we have. And then the second question I have is, what were the new tabulators in 2020? Thank you.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, there are 305 or six precinct tabulators that are used at precincts. Mm-hmm. The other 105 or 106 precincts are hand counted. So that's a total number of tabulators that are deployed out to the fields on election day in our various precincts. And I do not know what the cost of a forensic audit is.
Okay. Thank you.
Go ahead.
No, I'm good.
Go ahead. If you got a follow-up, it's fine.
It's okay. I just want to know, basically, she doesn't have any idea how much the cost of the forensic audit is. I mean, that to me is super important. And how many machines would you think would need to be audited was my question. Out of the 300, is 10% a good number? We have to get to the bottom of this, and I'm glad you're staying on it, to be honest with you. We've got to get some public integrity, some public trust back.
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Senator Reinbold, I'm not an expert in forensic audit. I do not feel like a subject matter expert that can even address these questions for you at this point in time.
Okay. Thank you.
And before I go to you, Scott, Tom, just real quick, do you, and you probably can't answer this and I can imagine, but I'm going to ask it because it continues to frustrate me. Do you know, did the Department of Law, who approved the redactions in that Commissioner Shibaka report line by line? And under what authority? Do you know who did that? Because it's awful frustrating to be the legislature and not be able to see a report that was produced by the administration that was designed to be released to the public, and we can't get it as sitting senators. Do you know who made those redactions and who approved them line by line?
Senator Schauer, those redactions were done by the Department of Law working with the administration, and we also have Alan Birnbaum here who can speak more to those if you have specific questions about them.
I do. Alan, you're on the floor.
Good evening. So,
Just put yourself on the record real quick, Alan, first. Thanks. Please. Thank you.
Sure. Alan Birnbaum. I'm Chief of the Information and Project Support Section in the Department of Law. And to respond to your question, as Tom said, we reviewed them within the Department of Law and then discussed our review with persons within the administration. And, of course, all of those discussions are protected under the attorney-client privilege. They're also protected as part of the deliberative process privilege and executive communications privilege.
I didn't quite answer my question there, but so I assume every one of those redactions then was approved by you, the Department of Law head, the Lieutenant Governor. Was it a collective decision? How did that happen?
Well, as I said, I'm comfortable getting into communications between me and our client agencies. So I don't have a response for you right now.
Alan, let me tell you something right now, sitting in my position, and I'm going to be very harsh about this. I am sick and tired of getting an answer as a sitting legislator unable to do my job when I have on the record the former commissioner tell me that she was asked to produce this report for public consumption. That report has been withheld from us for almost a year, and when I finally get to look at it, half of it, the important part that tells me how I can do my job, is redacted. There is no classified information in that. There isn't. Well, I was told by the commissioner before she left this administration, we have her on the record and talking a lot of conversations, that that did not exist, what you just said. Now, you may be telling me what you believe to be true, and that's fine. I'm telling you that there is conflicting information I'm getting that tells me the commissioner said it was produced for public consumption, that in the public interest, the good of the public interest, there is no client attorney privilege information. So I've got a problem here with how this has played out for us, because this makes it difficult for another branch of government to do its job when an information report that should be produced under the freedom, it's not Freedom of Information Act, I know that, but the records request, can't get it. So I'll leave it there because I know that you can certainly respond if you want to before that, but I will tell you, Alan, it's not sitting well with me what has happened with this report that prevents me from doing my job. I'm sorry, partner, but client attorney privilege does not work here. From how this does, and that also comes from conversations with the previous commissioner, and that was briefed. I'm sorry, it is not. I keep hearing that this was a interim report. It is not. She told me on the record it was produced, and the final report was briefed on July 13th of 2020. So stop telling me, that this report was not a final report. It absolutely was. I'm tired of hearing this, and I'm tired of being blocked as a sitting senator that has a job to do. So enough. And that's not you, Alan. I get it. You can say what you need to say. If you want to respond, you're welcome to. But I am tired in this position of being blocked for information that I need to do my job when I know that the things that I'm hearing are not the entire truth. I'm done. Alan, you can respond, then Senator Reinbold.
Thank you, Chair. Just to clarify, my reference to the attorney-client privilege is with respect to my communications with persons within the administration regarding the redactions. The redactions, none of them were made based on the attorney-client privilege. The redactions were only made based on the deliberative process privilege, the executive communications privilege, and under 40.25.120A10, which protects state security.
And Alan, in response to that before Senator Reinbold, what good is it, and this is rhetorical, you can't answer this way, and I understand that. What good is it to spend the time and money and manpower time and hours to produce a report like that that's supposed to give us information to help us do our job if it's simply going to be withheld from everybody that can do the job? It's a rhetorical question. It makes no sense to me whatsoever. And quite frankly, it's unconscionable that I can't get that report so that everybody can see it. Senator Reinbold.
And I'm going to piggyback on all that. Alan, I think I've asked for 16 public records requests, and I do / freedom of information as well, just to double cross. You are the one that is blocking tons of information to me, and it is frustrating as heck, like travel records from the governor on where he went to find out all this COVID stuff that has dramatically changed the state of Alaska. So I'm pretty ticked off to actually have an outside lawyer looking into what you are doing to us blocking information, which I am kind of done with as well, because you are the person that the buck stops. You are keeping us from doing our jobs. My staff, for the 10 years I've been here, has said the number one issue they have is blocking information from the administration. And I'll tell you, you got a lot of people pretty upset, and your name's on the line in regards to what's going on, because we're tired of all these information waiting, delays. You're not following the law, and it's really frustrating. So this may turn into a bigger issue.
Thanks, Senator Ramble. Alan, I apologize, put you on the hot seat there. There's, you can hear it, a lot of frustration coming out because we're desperate for information, and it was produced, and it's hard to see it. I got a note just now that, oh, it's been released, but what's been released to the public is a redacted version. And having read it, it's pretty much doesn't help me do my job when the 3 pages and 18 solutions or proposed solutions are redacted. So it's really hard to do that, and it puts me in quite the untenuous position as I sit here and go, if I talk about this, am I going to be held accountable? Are they going to come after me? Are they going to threaten to sue me? That's a problem. I keep wanting to do it. Scott, do you have other – and Director, if you have a comment, you're welcome to there. You're probably happy to not be in the hot seat for a moment or have questions thrown at you, but any comments on that? I didn't think there would be. Probably smart play. Scott, anything else we're missing here before we want to close it up, because I've held everybody late.
Chairman, Scott Ogan, staff for you. In a former job, I managed a team of attorneys for the state of Alaska, and we I'm not going to imply that there was anything – illegal going on in the Department of Law, but let me tell you my experience with the federal solicitors. We sued over a river in the 40-mile district. It was called the Mosquito Fork. And before we sued, we pulled every record that we could find out of the public office and public files. And we asked for all those records in discovery. In the discovery, under the discovery, we got this document that looked a great deal like the document that I've seen a copy of from that we're talking about. And when we read the original document, which we had obtained earlier, there were so many things on there that was exculpatory towards our claim or our lawsuit. It was astounding. And we had a meeting with the federal solicitors, and I said, well, what are all these redactions? And, oh, those are attorney-client privileged confidential things that you're not entitled to. I said, no, they aren't. I held it up, the original document. They said, where did you get those? Well, we got them out of the public record before we sued you. Briefcase is slammed down. This meeting is over. 2 days later, they settled with us out of court. So I'm not going to imply that there's anything illegal or nefarious going on by the Department of Law. But all I'm saying is from my experience dealing with some attorneys, I've seen, and that's really, they could have been disbarred, frankly. That's something you don't do in discovery, for sure. Now, the discovery rules are different than public records rules. But, you know, when I worked, we did all those interactions all the time. And we did have the Department of Law look over every one of our redactions when we provided information to the other side. So, but to say it could never happen, you know, I've personally seen it happen with another agency and other lawyers. And I'm not implying that it happened here, but it happens.
All right. Thanks, Scott. And I will tell you that, you know, what I have been advised by counsel is that in the greater, and I probably have the language wrong because I'm just a dumb pilot and I don't understand the legal side of things, but that if it is in the greater public interest or the greater public good, then the attorney-client privilege and the executive privilege do not exist. And so I am contending right now that that is something that should be released because this affects the entire state. This is an internal monologue of the administration about a policy that would be something narrow. This affects everybody in the state, and I disagree with where this is at. So be it. The battle is joined, and we're where we're at. And Alan, Tom, everybody else that was online, thank you for going over, and thank you for taking the time and letting us throw the heat downrange on this one. Because I know sometimes it's uncomfortable. Director, I really appreciate you going over and coming here to answer questions because I know there was a lot of things at stake, and I look forward, I really do, to the ranked choice voting discussion. We've got you coming back, I believe, after you brief the House. We're going to have you come back and give us that same briefing about ranked choice voting so we can kind of talk that, ask questions, and go through as well another big thing that's taking place. So I really appreciate your time today because this has been a lot to go through it, and it's nice to see you in person as opposed to having to do this on Zoom like we've done so much for the last couple of years. So with that being said, committee members, thanks for your patience. Any follow-up comments before I get us out of here? Director, any final comments you'd like to put on the record?
No, Mr. Chairman, I will go through my notes and make sure that we provide you in a timely manner as possible the information I promised.
I appreciate that. And from the folks that have had to be in the hot seats on the Zoom, is there any final comments from law or anyone else that would like to make sure it's on the record before we go? Okay, thank you. At this point, I'll let you know real quick, we're going to conclude our business for today here. The Senate State Affairs Committee will be meeting again this Thursday, January 20th, 2022 at 3:30 p.m. in this same room. We'll have Mr. Bill Smith, the Division of Admin, Chief of Information Office, will be addressing and updating the Committee on the State of Alaska IT Protocols, discussing the vulnerabilities we have. And we'll also have a guest presenter, Mr. Murray, from the Maine Policy Institute, to also discuss and kind of get us on track with Ballot Measure 2 as we go through that before the director is able to come in and brief us on that. I need a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Thank you very much. Seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 5:22 p.m. Thank you.